Joining us on the line, a reporter for the NFL Network and NFL.com. You can reach him on Twitter at Albert Breer. He does an outstanding job covering all the league issues for NFL Network and NFL.com, and he'll be part of the NFL Network's training camp coverage. Inside Training Camp Live starts next Wednesday, 10 a.m., as they start to cycle throughout the training camps all over the league. On the line with us live, Albert Breer from NFL Network. Albert, good to talk with you. Thanks very much for coming on with us tonight.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
Lot to talk about, including a story that you wrote over the last couple of weeks or so. Who's really in charge? I enjoyed that series. You went through every team in the NFL, Albert, and talked about who the decision makers are, who pulls the triggers on the big deals. And I found the Bills item particularly interesting, especially the perspective you got from an NFL or an NFC executive. Apparently, people around the league sat up and took notice of the Bills' power structure shakeup this offseason, huh?
Yeah, you know, and I think it's interesting because, you know, John, this really goes back to 2010 when they brought Buddy Nix in, and a lot of people were pretty surprised they were able to get Doug Whaley out of Pittsburgh. Perception out there in around the NFL, was that Whaley wasn't going anywhere because, you know, for one thing, you know, people generally don't leave Pittsburgh, and for another, Whaley had such deep roots there. So, seeing the evolution of the franchise and what happened this offseason with them, putting Whaley in a position of power where he's going to be the decision maker on all football calls, and then being able to go and get a coach he can grow with, and Doug Marrone, who's got a name in Western New York and who has head coaching experience and also has an NFL pedigree. You know, I think a lot of people around the NFL are interested to see how this whole thing's going to work out, you know, just based on, you know, the fact that it's new blood, but it's also, you know, a guy who's in charge who's got a lot of experience within the organization.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting to see how the whole thing plays out because, really, in a lot of ways, you look at Jacksonville and San Diego, teams like that went young with their hires. It's the same sort of idea. Yeah, but the Bills are doing it, from a position of strength because they have the institutional knowledge and the guys that are making their GM.
Here's what the one line that the quote you got from an unnamed NFC executive I found particularly interesting, and this executive told you, it's the first injection of creativity into their head coaching and front office in a very long time. Tell me about that. What do you think that NFC executive had in mind there?
Well, I mean, you know, you go back and you look at the hires that they've made there over the years, and, I go back to the last one, Chan Gailey. I think a lot of people looked at that as kind of a retread type of hire. Obviously, Buddy Nix was a hire who, Buddy's got a lot of, got a good name in the NFL, and he's a well-respected guy, but, that was a hire, I think, that was looked at as, let's try and play back the Bill Polian days. Of course, they had Marv Levy in charge when they brought him back. About what it was that 10 years ago now. Yep. So you look at a lot of their hires in the past and they haven't really, been outside the box. They've been guys who've been around the NFL for a long time. And I think that's the perception really was that that's what Ralph wanted there, that Ralph wanted an experienced guys that he felt comfortable with, had the experience of having been there. I think what they did this offseason, kind of reflects a little bit more outside the box thinking in that, they went into the college game, and it wasn't a guy from an Alabama or a Michigan. It was a guy they bringing in from a school like Syracuse, who won in a place that's not all that easy to win. In that way, it's kind of like a little reflective of Greg Schiano, who was able to win at Rutgers, a place that wasn't easy to win. And so you have that, and then on top of that, again, I think just the presence of Doug Whaley there, I think, really helps. Because the respect that he had within the Steeler organization, the job that he did there over the years, and the fact that even going back to, 3-4 years ago when they were able to get him out of there, what a coup that was considered. So, I think that there was the element outside the box thinking with Marrone coming in, and then on top of it, it's just the amount of respect that people have for Whaley around the league. I think that a lot of people look at it and say, okay, now this looks like a franchise that's got a singular philosophy now, and is going to, have a group there, between Russ and Doug and Doug that they can grow together with.
Albert Breer is our guest from NFL.com and NFL Network. And the thing about this series, Albert, you went through every team, division by division, eight-part series, 32 teams and their power structure. And I guess when it was all said and done, what struck me is that there's no one way to do it. And, you know, I think it was John Butler who used to say when he was here, you know, there's more than one way to skin a cat when it comes to setting up the decision-making process in any NFL franchise, huh?
Yeah, and I thought what was interesting was when I went out and set out to do it, I kind of thought, like, okay, I'm going to be able to categorize them, you know, and this team is GM-driven, this team is coach-driven, this team is owner-driven. You know, and really what I found when I went into it is that, you know, I guess you can do that to a degree, but even within the GM-driven models, there was a lot of variation. You know, there weren't all that many coach-driven models left, and, you know, the owner-driven models might not have been set up like a lot of people thought. So, you know, it's just it's different from team to team. Some teams have, you know, a layer underneath the owner, between the owner and the football people. Other teams don't. You know, some of the owner-driven models, you know, the Dallas was really interesting in that, to find out that only two people really report to the owner, and that's Stephen Jones and Jason Garrett. You know, so it's just a variation from team to team. Even within those, even within, you know, you could categorize Buffalo as a GM-driven model, you know, but that doesn't mean Buffalo necessarily is exactly like, you know, a San Diego or an Atlanta where those are GM-driven models, you know. So even within, you know, those models, even within like a GM-driven model, there was a lot of variation. I thought that part of it was really interesting.
John Murphy Show presented by NOCO. We're live on the line with Albert Breer, reporter for the NFL Network, NFL.com. You can catch him starting next Wednesday when the NFL Network starts its training camp coverage, Inside Training Camp Live, starting Wednesday at 10 a.m. Hey, Albert, of course, everybody here in Buffalo is all, you know, following Jarris Bird and the franchise tag. And a week ago, you wrote a story on NFL.com about the failure of the franchise tag this year. And I just want to quote one line from it and have you elaborate. You said, this year, or here it is, if the tag was originally conceived as a placeholder for long-term deals, this year stands as a glaring example of its failure. It probably hurts more guys than it helps. Can you talk about that a little bit, Albert, and why the franchise tag doesn't work anymore in the league?
Well, you know, I mean, I think for the most part what you see now, and this isn't everybody, because there are certainly teams that have used the franchise tag as a placeholder to get long-term deals done. But I think what you're seeing more often than not now is that teams are being a little bit more aggressive with their core players. And so, you know, they'll identify 7-8 guys on their team, and they'll say, these are the guys that we want to keep around long-term. And in a lot of cases, those guys are getting done earlier. So you'll see, you know, a guy get a contract with 2 years left on his deal or a year left on his deal. And so then they don't need the franchise tag to hold on to those guys. So what ends up happening is, the trickle-down effect here is that, you know, then now the franchise tag can be used in a different way. And in some of those cases, it's used to hold a guy over for an extra year. And I think, you know, a good example of it would probably be Deshaun Golson in San Francisco, where, you know, they decided, you know, they weren't going to pay him, they weren't going to give him an Eric Weddle deal. They decided that he was just outside of their core. So what they did was, they said, okay, we're going to need to hold on to him for a year. They held on to him for that extra year. And then, you know, the second year of that, they positioned themselves to go ahead and trade up, get Eric Reed in the draft, let Deshaun Golson walk. So I think that might be like kind of one of the ones that sticks out. You know, and you see in these cases, you know, like if a team doesn't want to, you know, hold on to a player long term, it's a good way for them to be able to get the extra year out of him before letting him go. Now with Jarris Bird, I don't think that the Bills necessarily want to see the guy walk. I think it's more of a pure disagreement on what the player's value is. And so those can happen as well, but you know, certainly I think it gives the team a chance to at least kind of put the pause button on the player's free agency, get another year out of the guy, and in most cases, those players are highly, highly motivated to go out and have, you know, great years because they're looking at free agency again, and then, you know, in a lot of these cases, make a decision, and sometimes it can cause acrimony between the team and the player. That's part of the risk that the team runs in holding on to guys for an extra year.
I've been thinking that maybe the issue with Jarris Bird and the Bills is the position that he plays, Albert. I mean, you know, the question of how much value do you put on a safety? Do you agree?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I think one of the things, and the safeties are in a tough spot the same way the tight ends are in a tough spot where the number's really low and affordable. And so I think sometimes what it can do in those cases is, you know, create resentment or create confusion over how the team feels about the player. Because it's one thing if, you know, you're Brandon Albert and, you know, the Chiefs are tagging you, and yeah, maybe it's not what you wanted, but you're still getting $10 million guaranteed. Or Michael Johnson, you know, in Cincinnati, where, you know, it's $11.2 million guaranteed. It's like, yeah, you know, it stinks that I don't get long-term security, but I'm still walking away with a lot of money. Well, you know, you're not getting that top dollar in some of those positions. So Jairus Bird's sitting there, and, you know, he's got the, you know, $6.8 million tag, I think it is, on him. You know, it can create, you know, it's, you know, for safety, he's going to look at the top of the market, and the tag isn't all that close to the top of the market. You know, so he wants what Eric Weddle got, which is about $8 million a year, and he thinks he's that type of difference-making player. And, you know, it may not necessarily be that the Bills disagree with that and disagree with the idea that he is, you know, among the top players in this position. They may just look at it and say, well, the franchise tag dictates what the market is for the top players in the position, so we should be paying you, you know, on an annual basis right around what the franchise tag is. And so when there's a divide between where that franchise tag number is and where the average annual value at the top of the market is, it can create, it can sometimes create a problem, and I think that's part of it there. And yeah, I mean, another part of it, of course, is how you value that safety position. If you don't value it like a corner or a pass rusher, and clearly you see how the Bills, you know, value those pass rushers, what they paid for Mario Williams, you know, then there is going to be a disagreement.
What's the likeliest outcome for Jairus Bird? Do you think? Go ahead.
I don't think he's reporting next week. I mean, I'll tell you that. I mean, that's just my gut. You know, and I know, you know, Eugene Parker's obviously a very respected agent through the league for a reason. And one of the reasons why is he generally gets his clients what they want, you know, and, they've never been afraid to hold players out. And so my guess is that he doesn't show next week, and there are two benefits to it. Now, he can't get the long-term deal. We know that ship sailed. But, the first benefit, of course, is the obvious, which, you know, it's, he's going to avoid, you know, the risk of injury by sitting out 4 or 5 weeks of camp. And the other is that, you know, maybe, you know, he can get the team a little uneasy, and he can say, I'm not going to report, and, you know, and hold out and try to get the some sort of assurance that he won't be tagged again in 2014. So those are really the two things to gain there. You know, I think from his perspective, it may be worth it for him, you know, to save some of those extra hits on his body. He's got a new coach coming in. So that's part of the drawback that maybe you have you might be a little bit behind as far as the system goes. You know, but for a player in that position, a lot of times, you know, your eyes are kind of looking towards 2014. And so being able to get assurances that you're going to hit the market and, you know, give yourself a better chance to be healthy could take precedent.
Albert Breer joins us, reporter for NFL Network, NFL.com. Before we let you go, Albert, I want to ask you about the story you wrote today about really the troubling case of Aaron Hernandez and the Patriots. And from this perspective, do we fault, with all the red flags that were around Aaron Hernandez and all the study that goes into these players before they're drafted, are the Patriots at fault for drafting him? That's part one. And part two, are teams obligated to fix these troubled players when they come into the league? Is that even possible?
Well, I mean, the first part of the question, I would say you got to draw a line. Can the Patriots? Can you tell the Patriots? Can you go to the Patriots and say you should have seen a murderer coming down the pike? No, you know. But was it plausible or even considered likely when he was drafted that at some point he was going to have a problem that was going to get him in trouble and maybe, you know, cost him some games, cost him a season, whatever it is? That was completely something that a lot of people saw coming. And Part of the reason why, you know, he was available for him in the fourth round. So they rolled the dice. They struck out there. They can, you know, look right in the mirror for the blame on that one. You know, that's what happens sometimes, is that when you take chances on players who've got, you know, who are coming in and are already on their second chance, sometimes that happens. As far as the team's responsibility to mentor a player, I mean, I look at a lot of that, you know, and say that, you know, the team's got some responsibility to try and make sure that they've got solid citizens in the community, and that the responsibility to themselves that they're being represented in the right way. You know, but I don't look at these individual teams as rehab centers or anything like that. You know, I don't think you can look at a professional football team and say, you know, it's your responsibility if a guy's an alcoholic to cure him. It's your responsibility if a guy's got a drug problem to fix it. You know, any more than you would any other private business. So I wouldn't put any blame on them for what wound up happening. But I also don't have much sympathy for them either. I mean, right. You know, you take as many chances as the Patriots have over the years, eventually you're going to get burned. I don't know if you could have possibly predicted that something like this was going to happen. But, you know, the idea that something bad could happen, you know, certainly was part of, you know, that was part of the package when you sign up for somebody like, you know, Aaron Hernandez and the rap sheet that he had coming out of Florida. Yeah.
Very unfortunate. Albert, are you going to make your way up to St. John Fisher College?
I hope so. You know, I'm covering the Hernandez hearing on Wednesday. I got the Patriots the first couple of days of camp, and then it's kind of wide open from there. I'm not sure where I'm going yet, but you guys have an interesting one. Like I said, that, you know, the new regime there, I think, created some excitement. And of course, any place there's a rookie quarterback, it's always intriguing to watch, you know, how camp plays out. So, well, there's going to be a fair amount of eyeballs on Buffalo, you know, going through July and August and seeing if E.J. Manuel can win that job.
It's going to be fun. Albert, thank you for spending time with us this Friday night. Have a great weekend, and hopefully we'll see you in Pittsburgh, New York soon in a couple of weeks.
Absolutely. Anytime, John.